This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. We do a lot of cases on this program. We talk a lot about issues that you face, whether you're planning for retirement, you're in retirement, or you're taking care of your parents who are in retirement. And those are some of the issues that we're going to be addressing here on the program. And for many of you, if you're working in the private sector and even in the government sector where you might have, let's say, savings programs, whether it's a 403B program, a 457 plan at the government, or if you're in the private sector, 401K programs. There are a lot of things that you could be doing to better prepare yourself for retirement. There are a lot of approaches out there that people talk about. Well, you know, these, what we call them, cookie cutter approaches. You're at a certain age, this is the way you need to invest. Well, you know what? That doesn't apply in this kind of marketplace today. Everyone's a little bit different. They may have different assets, different objectives and goals. So those are some of the things that we're going to be talking about today to better prepare and become a smarter investor in preparing for retirement.
I'm Kathleen Harris, and as Jim mentioned, later on in the program, we'll be talking a little bit about addressing issues that affect those of you who are possibly caring for parents who are approaching retirement or in retirement, sort of focusing a little bit more on the legal side of preparing for retirement with our guest, whose name is Gregory French. He's from the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and he'll be talking about some of the things you can do on the legal side to prepare for issues of incapacity with parents and loved ones in retirement.
And one of the things that we want to do is, there's a lot of software out there when you're putting together a financial plan. If you ever had one done, you get this long boilerplate document that could be 50, sometimes I've seen them over 100 pages. And we have these old allocation models, and I think those allocation models worked in a period as we had in the 80s and 90s, where you had a high degree of confidence in terms of what the investment markets were going to do and predictability in terms of where interest rates were. I mean, if you look at the 80s, I can remember a period of time where you got double digits on fixed income vehicles in the 80s. Now, I'm talking about government bonds. I can remember getting 8-9% on municipal tax-free bonds. I can remember getting 12-14%. One of the staples that we used in the 80s were things like Ginnie Mae's, mortgage-backed government entities, because they paid monthly income. And that's what people wanted. And those bonds, believe it or not, it almost seems like a pipe dream today. I can remember getting 12, 13, 14%. That was not out of line. Heck, I can remember getting almost 13% on utility stocks going back in the early part of the 80s. But then we got the 91 recession, Greenspan cut interest rates, and double-digit interest rates, whether it was bank CDs or bonds, were gone forever. So a lot of the asset allocation models today look back over long historical periods, and they're bringing those numbers or that experience into these models where it doesn't work. I'm looking at a Treasury screen today, folks, and this is just to give you an example. A two-year Treasury note is offering an interest rate that's a little over 0.2%. So look at it this way. If you had $1 million, you'd be making about $2,000 of interest. That certainly isn't going to put you in Beverly Hills or in a condominium on the beach in Florida. If I look at 10-year Treasury notes, 10-year Treasury notes are at 1.7%. So on $1 million, you would only get $17,000. I mean, it's just amazing what you can get today and how little you get on investing in money. So a lot of these old models of, at a certain age, you should put X amount of your portfolio in bonds, maybe less towards stocks. the old rule of thumb, I mean, you should subtract your age. Let's say take age 100, and that's the percentage of your portfolio that you should keep in stocks. So let's take, for example, your age 70. You subtract 70 from 100, you should only have 30% of your stock. Financial planners are recommending these rules, and sometimes changing these rules are necessary to put together a plan that really fits you in retirement, and especially in an age today where we're dealing with zero interest rates and central banks around the world have pledged to keep them there for a long period of time.
I think it's really important for our listeners to sort of understand the fact that even though there are some attempts to revise the ways that we think about retirement portfolio allocation, really significant changes still haven't been made. A lot of different investments that are based on those old models are still in play extremely heavily, especially in people's retirement portfolios. You know, I'm thinking, Jim, about target retirement mutual funds, which I know are a common component of a lot of our clients' retirement portfolios. You know, when they come to us at retirement, we take a look at their existing 401k assets. Oftentimes, they've been placed in a, you know, target retirement 2013, target retirement 2020 fund. And those funds are allocating assets based on these old models of how to do things.
Well, it's amazing because a lot of these target funds, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday of this past week, and they talk about target funds vulnerable to rate rises. And they talk about millions of workers are saving for retirement risk, losing part of their nest eggs if interest rates jump. The cause for concern are target date mutual funds designed for investors who lack the time or expertise to balance their investment portfolios. The funds typically increase their bond holdings with the approach of the target date. So let's say there's a target fund that says the date is 2025. As you get closer to that date, what they start doing is moving a larger and larger portion of the fund's portfolio into bonds. Well, that's good if we were in a stable environment or if interest rates didn't change. But if interest rates do rise, you could be putting yourself at big risk. And that's one of the problems that we're trying to address on today's program, is the problems with old allocation models. Number one, they may not cope effectively with inflation. What the Wall Street Journal article was talking about, the reason interest rates would rise is that inflation started to rise, which means interest rates would have to go higher to compensate investors for the loss of purchasing power if inflation increases. And they also don't take into account their sort of static type programs of different changing market conditions. I mean, think about it, if you're listening to this podcast, of the events that you have seen over the last 13 years. Do you remember what it was like in 1999 and 2000? Everybody was euphoric. We were all going to get rich because we were going to make double-digit returns every single year in the market. And for a period of time from 1995 to the year 2000, that's just exactly what happened in the market. But fast forward from 2000, number one, we had the tech bubble crash. Interest rates were slashed to 1% on the federal funds rate. Gone were the high single-digit returns that you could get into the bond market. And we were in almost a 30-month bear market. It wasn't until the end of 2002 that we began to come out of it. And things looked pretty good for about a 4 or 5 year period. The stock market went up. Real estate prices went up for many individuals, their main asset, and things were looking rosy again. But then along came 2007, and all the way up to 2009, the stock market once again lost nearly 40% of its value, the second time within a decade, and also the second recession that we experienced in a decade. Think back to the 80s and 90s, when we went 10 years without a recession, the markets were predictable, along with interest rates. And look what happened coming out of 2009. Did you ever believe in your wildest imagination you would live to see a period of time when the interest rate offered in money market funds would be near zero, or all you could get in a bank CD was less than 0.5%, or furthermore, a one-year treasury bill would only pay you one-tenth of 1%. So the problems with these old allocation models, they don't deal with, number one, addressing the issue of inflation. And I think all of you listening to this program can look back and say, am I paying less to live today than, let's say, what it cost me to live 5 years ago or 10 years ago? So they don't deal with inflation. They don't deal with changing market conditions. And more importantly, they're not specific to individual client needs, your particular needs, or for that matter, your particular tolerance for risk. Maybe after going through two bear markets, you may not have the tolerance for risk that you once had. So that's one of the problems that you have with these target funds. They're inflexible, and they don't deal with a lot of issues that you're going to have to be dealing with when you're planning your own retirement.
So we've outlined a couple of problems about these sort of cookie-cutter approaches. They're just not flexible. They don't reflect the individual client's needs. What can someone out there who's an investor who's got these options in front of them, what should they be doing or thinking about in terms of addressing this issue of, okay, how do I invest a plan for my specific retirement? What should I be doing in terms of just even quantifying that? We're often asked by people, and we've mentioned this before on the program, you know, Kathleen, Jim, how much should I be saving for retirement? Do I need to save $1 million, $2 million, $500,000? Do I have enough? And the answer is completely individual specific. It really depends on your individual situation, and we've said it over and over again, but the amount you need to save for retirement depends on two things, really. It depends, number one, on how much you're going to spend or how much you are spending. So you have to start with a budget. That is just, it's just a tough, hard reality out there, folks. You got to make yourself a budget. And the second thing is you got to know where you stand. Make a list of your assets, which is everything that you own on the positive side, and your liabilities, which is everything that you owe, whether it's credit card or mortgage or what have you. You subtract your liabilities from your assets, you've got your net worth. That's your overall position as far as where your family is at financially. What we do as financial advisors, and what any financial advisor you go to or any program you plug your numbers into, is going to take a look at your budget and your current net worth and say, given where you're at right now, this is how much you need to save in time for this spending program that's going to kick in at your retirement. So you have to start out with a budget. You have to know where you're at to figure out how long it's going to take you to get to a point where you can retire. Or if you're already in retirement, how long can I realistically expect my assets to last given how I'm currently spending them? And we've talked about a couple things here on the show about different people that we've dealt with, that we've solved a couple budgetary issues for them in terms of dealing with where they're at right now, what they have right now, and what their worries were, and also what their spend rates were. So, Jim, I know last week we talked a little bit about the Turner's family. Why don't we go back and talk about how we solved some of their retirement income problems?
Yeah, because really what we're trying to address here, Kathleen, is allocation mistakes. And many times people reach retirement and they have a lot of their portfolio or their assets are tied up with what I call non-income producing assets. And let's face it, when you retire, unless you have a generous pension plan, like a defined benefit plan or something that is going to replace what it is you're giving up by retiring and giving up your salary, you have to take a look at your assets. What are the things that you have that can turn into a reliable source of income? And I want to put reliable because that's what you're going to need. In many of the things that we have found in over the years, taking a look at doing planning, three come to mind. One of them is a rather new phenomenon that we've seen come into play in the last 10 years. But the first is second homes. And if you're listening to this podcast, you remember last week we talked about the Turners and their mammoth condo, which they were using less than 2 weeks out of the year, which was a significant amount of equity in relation to their overall portfolio. Another thing that we see as a result of two bear markets, and especially the financial crash of 2007 and 2009, we have a lot of investors that are still shell-shocked, that are sitting on cash waiting for Armageddon, and that cash has lost nearly 25% of its purchasing power since 2009. And a new phenomenon that we have seen, probably more so in this decade than any other time, because let's put it this way, outside this last decade who had their money invested in gold. And we see a lot of people put a lot of their assets into physical metals. Well, that's great. If you have a pension, Social Security, maybe you have you're working part-time and you don't need other assets that you have to access for income. But if you need income, having all your assets in gold is not a good idea. Now, last week, I talked about the Turners as a case study. And if you recall, they had this condo that they used when the kids were growing up. One of their hobbies was skiing. The unfortunate thing is that cost them nearly $12,000 a year. So not only was it not producing income, but it was costing them nearly $1,000 a month. If you take the mortgage payments, the property tax payments, the maintenance, the insurance. So by selling the condo, they reduced their expenses by $12,000 a year, and they were able to, one of their main concerns, because remember, on both Joe's side and Irene's side, both parents, their parents, they have longevity running into the family. In fact, Irene's mother was in a retirement home, and one of their main concerns was, how are we going to finance long-term care? We don't have the money for it. And to get policies on both Joe and Irene was going to cost $7,000. So what we did is we took the equity, we sold the condo because, you know, it'd be cheaper just to go up there and stay in a hotel than spend $1,000 a month to maintain it. And we were able to put it into annuities, one on Joe's life and one on Irene's. And that way we had enough money, we could annuitize and take care of long-term health care needs. And more importantly, we just created $200,000 of additional assets that they could either use for long-term care, if that was what would happen down the road, or for any other additional income, financial emergencies. Maybe they needed to buy a new car, they needed some extra money to take a trip. They now had $200,000 that was working for them, producing a reliable source of income. So we did two things here. One, we reduced their budget, or their spend rate was reduced significantly. And number two, we just created an asset stream that could produce income. So here was an example of a second home that was really not productive. It was ending up costing the Turners money, and we turned it into an income-producing asset instead.
I think this is a really important point, Jim, because as we just mentioned, budget, budget, budget. You have to know what your budget is. So one of the first things we addressed with the Turners was their budget. They were overspending on this condo, and it was really going to hamper their long-term ability to sustain themselves in retirement. And a second thing, again, just want to point out, we mentioned investors to make a list of your assets and liabilities. So we do that for the Turners, and we realize we have this asset that's acting a lot more like a liability for them. And so we change that around, and all of a sudden we have an investment plan for them that meets their needs. So again, what should I invest in for my retirement depends a lot on what you need and what you got. I want to talk a little bit about someone I've talked to recently, Jim, who came to me, and let's just call him Joe. And he had a portfolio of investments that was about $800,000. And about 50% of it was in precious metals. And he had about 35% in stocks. And the rest of it was in cash. And he came to me looking for income streams from his portfolio. And the problem with what his current allocation was is that only 35% of his entire net worth was going to do the work of producing all the income he needed. And the problem with holding bullion at that level, 50%, you've got two challenges. The first challenge is you're over-allocated. You're taking a lot of risk with a really risky investment. And I think the second thing that it's a problem is that if you need income from your overall assets and your overall portfolio, and you dedicate half or more of your portfolio to non-income producing assets, you are basically guaranteeing yourself a situation where you are eating heavily into principal every year as you try to meet income needs out of your portfolio, instead of making your portfolio work for you and produce more income, so your bite into your underlying portfolio assets is smaller and can last longer in retirement. I want to just kind of go through a scenario with this investor to show how it is that holding half of your assets in a non-income producing asset class can really hamper you. So let's just talk about where Joe is at right now. Right now, he's got 35% of his $800,000 portfolio investing in the market, producing income, and hopefully growing for him. So if he's got 35% of his $800,000 portfolio in the market, that's about $280,000. Let's just say that Joe has that portfolio invested in a portfolio of stocks that have a lower upfront dividend but a higher dividend growth rate. So they're paying maybe 2.5%. That $280,000 portfolio is only going to make him $7,000 a year. If he invests in a portfolio of stocks that pay a slightly higher dividend but have a lower dividend growth rate, let's just say 3.5%, his portfolio will make him $9,800 a year. That's out of $800,000, he's making $9,800 a year because he only has 35% dedicated to stocks. Now, I don't know about you, Jim, but I can't survive on $9,800 a year. This isn't going to happen.
No, not too many people can. And if you live in Southern California, there's no way you're going to survive on that. Once again, unless you had a very, very generous pension plan in Social Security where investment income wasn't as important, and maybe what you got from your investments is what we call the bucket list. Because when we do retirement planning, we always try to get people to focus on their budget in two ways. The essential budget, which is what it costs you to live. You know, that's your mortgage payment, your taxes, your insurance, your food, your gasoline, all those things that you need to live on a day-to-day basis. And then we have what we call the bucket list. These are the extra things you'd like to do. With the Turners, it was travel. And if you're spending, you know, 20 grand a year in travel, well, that's something that your portfolio can help pay for. But when you're looking at basic expenses, you better have a generous pension or Social Security or another source of income. Maybe you work part-time, because if you're going to put it in a non-producing asset, whether it's a second home in the case of Turner's, or in this case, your potential client Joe, who had it 50% in metals, you know, even if you put it in the best producing income assets, there's no way that you could live on that kind of income stream.
Well, what I proposed for him, Jim, was that he put about 85% of his assets to work producing income instead of only 35. And so I decided, you know, he was someone who really felt strongly about being invested in metals. So I told him, you know what? Keeping 10% of your portfolio in metals is probably okay for you, given where you're at in your life, the fact you've been investing in them for such a long time. Let's keep you at a reasonable 10%, and let's give you 5% cash cushion for some, you know, emergency spending or some play money to buy if the stock market goes down. We get some good buying opportunities. So by moving his portfolio to 85% income producing assets, you know, we could go from producing only $7,000 a year for him to up to $17,000, $23,000, depending on what types of assets we put him in. And here's the bottom line, Jim. The more income your portfolio produces for you, the less of a bite you take out of your underlying principal. So let's just say that Joe's budget was $60,000 a year, and his portfolio, which was, let's just say it was dedicated 35% to stocks, and it was only making him $7,000 a year. He was going to be taking $53,000 worth out of the underlying assets in his portfolio to meet his income need. That means every single year, his portfolio is decreasing in value by $53,000. So you can see how even by increasing the amount of income his portfolio is generating by $10,000 or $14,000, the amount that he's pulling out of the portfolio is extremely decreased, which I want to cut Joe a little bit of a break here because, you know, he's someone that's been listening to you for a long time and started investing in metals when you first started talking about it, you know, way back in the early 2000s. And he didn't start off with half his portfolio in precious metals. It just kept growing in value and growing in value and growing in value until it became 50% of his portfolio. And Jim, since I know that you're a big fan of investing in precious metals, at least with a part of your money, would you mind talking about why it's not such a good idea to put, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70% of your portfolio in precious metals?
Well, the best example I can give you is what we've seen happen to gold here since it peaked in September of, let's say, 2011. I mean, it went from 1921, got all the way down to 1321. When you think about that, Kathleen, that's a $600 drop, almost more than 30%. So that's right off the bat. That's one reason you don't want to do that. And, you know, you want gold in the portfolio, but you also have to take a look at what your income needs are. And I think a lot of people with gold, the way it went from 250 all the way to 1900, or coming out of the 2008 financial crisis, it went from, you know, almost 700 all the way up to 1900. It was up 180%. But one of the things that you always do in a portfolio is you should rebalance. I mean, when gold got to 1900, we reduced gold in our portfolios. I reduced gold personally. When silver got up to 48, we reduced our silver holdings and we actually put puts on in the market because it got way overextended and where it should be. And there's always that tendency when a market goes straight up, as you know, think of technology stocks from 1995 to 2000, you think it's, you know, there's no end to it. Well, we do know that there is an end to these things. They do correct, and especially when some asset class, whether it's tech stocks or gold, has a big sharp run like gold did from, let's say, coming out of the 2008 crisis all the way up to 2011, or what tech stocks did from 95 to, let's say, the year 2000. And so gold has a place in all portfolios, but remember, it's a non-producing asset. It's kind of like having an insurance policy. It's there, it protects you, it's a store of value, but having everything in one asset class, because we all know markets can change, government policy can change. We know, for example, that the tax rate on bullion is much higher than it is in financial assets. And who's not to say if gold really took off that the government could make that gold stranded by saying, you know what, we're going to add an additional tax, a windfall profits tax on gold for gold investors. You think they can't do that? Remember the taxation of Social Security when that was supposed to be tax-free? And look what they did to oil companies in the 70s when oil took off. They slapped a windfall profits tax that remained in effect for almost a full decade. So you never want to have all your assets in one basket, because the markets can change, tax laws can change, and more importantly, you want to have something that is going to provide you with a level of income and stability. That's not what gold is used for. Gold is a hedge. It's a hedge against currency debasement. It is an insurance policy. And certainly today, you wouldn't spend all your money and go out and say, you know what, I'm going to buy as many life insurance policies as I can, or I'm going to have three or four policies for homeowners insurance, or I'm going to have three or four policies on my car. You wouldn't do that. And it's the same thing with gold. It has a purpose. It belongs in a portfolio, but don't make it your entire portfolio, because you put yourself at risk and it's not going to accomplish all the things that you need from it. It's there for an insurance policy. And in this case, you don't put all your money in insurance.
I think this is a really good point to make, Jim. And I think the other point that sort of comes out of this conversation as well is that if you're an investor that needs income from your assets, you need to be looking at all your assets. I've been talking to investors recently who tell me they don't look at their gold, especially their gold and silver bullion, as being part of their overall net worth or part of their overall source of possible income. And the reality is that if you're someone who needs a high level of income and has a modest level of assets, you need to really take into account all your assets and make those hard choices about reallocating so that you'll be able to get the income that you need and have your assets last for your whole lifetime. Because you don't want to hit a situation where you run out of assets when you need to go into a care facility, for example, or a big health expense comes up. You want to make sure you can take care of yourself for your entire lifetime. Well, Jim, just to wrap things up, I just want to remind our listeners that coming up later on the program is Mr. Gregory French from the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. He and Jim will be talking about the three necessary legal documents you need to have in place or in hand before you consider going into a long-term care facility, and the three things you should look at when you're actually going into a facility. First of all, when do you go? How do you select a facility? And how do you pay for it? So coming up next on the program, for all those of you who are thinking about, planning for, or considering going into a retirement facility, really important program for you to listen to coming up next.
It's no secret that Americans are living longer. But into old age, well, sometimes they're running into problems, everything from disabilities to dementia. Joining me on the program today is Gregory French. He's a certified elder law attorney. Mr. French, one of the aspects of retirement that we're seeing more and more frequently today is either one spouse ends up going into a long-term care facility dealing with issues like dementia, Alzheimer's, or even things like rheumatoid arthritis. I'd like to talk and begin with, what are the legal documents that are necessary when a spouse becomes incapacitated for, let's say, either the children or the well spouse in order to facilitate medical care?
There are three types of documents that are critical. One are documents that express the individual's wishes with respect to, if I can't make my health care decisions anymore, this is the person I want to make those decisions. And in most states, that is called a health care power of attorney. Related to that is a living will. And a living will is a document in which the individual can state his or her intentions to the doctor as to what sort of end-of-life care does the individual want. So healthcare decisions are one set of documents that are critical. A second set of documents are financial documents, and by far the most important of those is a financial power of attorney. And what a financial power of attorney does is it specifies what someone, the individual trust, can do to manage his or her financial affairs should the day come when that person no longer can make his or her own decisions. And then the third set of documents that are helpful are what happens after the individual's death. And for most of us, we have a will that for those assets that pass by the will says, here's where they go. Here's who receives my assets. Sometimes it makes sense to, in addition, have a trust with a will, and the trust can tell where the documents go following the individual's death.
When you have somebody that becomes incapacitated, let's say an elder couple, and I'll pick on the husband. The husband becomes incapacitated. What are some of the advantages of a trust where both husband and wife are trustees? Does it make it much easier to facilitate care issues or medical issues?
A trust is quite helpful with respect to avoiding probate, and sometimes we do a type of trust that into which we can place funds in order to protect those funds from the cost of long-term care. That's a different type of trust, often referred to as an irrevocable trust. So there are lots of types of trust depending on what we are trying to accomplish, what the client is trying to accomplish. The attorney decides which type of trust is most appropriate and then customizes that trust to the client's particular circumstances.
So you can have, let's say, assets designated or protected in an irrevocable trust so they can't be attached or used for long-term care. Let's talk about what happens if it comes to the point where, let's say, a client has dementia, has Alzheimer's, and you're at a situation where they definitely have to be put into a long-term care facility. Mr. French, what are some of the important things that the well spouse or the children should be looking at when either, one, making that decision to go into a long-term care facility, and number two, choosing the well long-term care facility, and number three, paying for the long-term care facility?
Those are exactly what the spouse and children should be considering. And let's begin with what type of help or care does the person need? And the question is, can we meet this person's needs at home is the person's condition such, and do we have the money to help keep the person at home? And if so, we keep the person at home as long as possible, because almost everybody wants to stay at home as long as possible. If the person's needs are such that it no longer is safe for both him and his spouse for him to continue residing at home, then we may look at an assisted living facility. An assisted living facility is halfway between a living at home and living in a nursing home. For those of us who need even more care than that, we're looking at a nursing home or a long-term care facility. So we keep the person, primary goals are to keep the individual as independent and with as high quality of life as possible based on the individual's finances and health condition. With respect to second question that you asked about how do I select the right type of facility, for example, with nursing homes, the federal government has an excellent website which rates nursing homes and which provides a lot of information on any nursing home that is certified to receive either Medicare or Medicaid dollars. And one way to get to that website is simply to go to Medicare.gov, Medicare.gov. And on that website, you can enter in your state, and then you can get to your county, and then you can get to the name of the nursing home, and you can use that information to select an appropriate nursing home. Assisted living facilities, that's going to depend on to what extent, if any, does your state contain information on assisted living facilities. And care at home, there's even less of a database. So for assisted living facilities, and in particular care at home, you're going to be looking at doing some reference checking and really checking out the organization. And with respect to how do you pay for it, there are three primary ways to pay for long-term care, and none of them involve Medicare, because Medicare doesn't pay for long-term care. The first source of funds is your own savings. The second source of help can be long-term care insurance. Now, if you don't already have long-term care insurance, you're not going to be able to buy it when you enter the nursing home. But if you are healthy, or relatively healthy, and don't need nursing home care now, long-term care insurance is something worth exploring. For many people, ultimately, the cost of long-term care, which in Cincinnati, which is where I practice, is about $100,000 a year. And we're looking at Medicaid helping to pay for that sort of care, and there are financial eligibility requirements to qualify for Medicaid. And that's where families really need to go to a qualified elder law attorney for advice, and the organization of which I am president, the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, has more than 4,400 such attorneys across the country.
So when you get into a situation, let's talk about a situation where you have one spouse. It could be a surviving spouse, or it could be just one of, let's say, a husband within a marriage. And you sort of suspect that the one spouse either has dementia, has Alzheimer's. What are the steps that you need to go through to make sure that, you know, you're certified or you're allowed to make certain decisions? Because obviously the person that is unwell, that has the disease, number one, may not realize they have the disease and may do things that could be harmful to their own health or even harmful to the couple's finances.
It's another excellent question. And if an individual needs, is beginning to lose the ability to make decisions, we have to remember that if we're wanting to manage his money, it's his money. And the legal question is, what right does anybody else have to manage or spend or otherwise utilize somebody else's money? And that gets back to the financial power of attorney. So everybody, every adult, no matter of what age, because younger people can get in auto accidents as well, should have a financial power of attorney. And this financial power of attorney can enable the holder of the power of attorney to take steps to not only pay for care, but to protect funds for a spouse or for other children. So financial power of attorney is very important, but you can only get it when the person still has the ability to make decisions. If the person has totally lost the ability to make decisions, then you're stuck with the expensive and time-consuming process of having to go to court to obtain a guardianship in order to have the legal authority to do something with someone else's money.
I want to talk about long-term care facilities. You mentioned that the government has a site at Medicare that you can find out how these facilities are rated. If there are problems where you suspect, let's say that the spouse or individual staying at the facility is not getting the proper care, because we've heard about horror stories, 60 Minutes have done stories about it, what are the actions or things that you should be looking for, and how would one proceed?
With respect to making sure that you receive high-quality nursing home care, the first step is to do everything you can at the front end to place a loved one in an appropriate facility. And utilizing the Medicare.gov website is a good start. You're also going to need to visit the facility and really trust your senses. What you see, what you hear, what you smell are very good indications of the quality of a facility. Once a loved one is in a facility, the single biggest factor as far as quality of care is the involvement of family and friends. The more family and friends that visit on different days at different times makes a huge difference in the quality of care that an individual can receive. And if there are problems, often they can be resolved by the family being very diplomatic and polite, but very firm as to the care, the quality of care that the loved one deserves. If that doesn't solve the problem, throughout the entire country, there are what are called long-term care ombudsmen who are employed and funded in most parts of the country by area agencies on aging. And in most of the country, they are very good at helping families resolve issues with nursing homes. Ultimately, if the problem really becomes severe, an appropriate elder law attorney can make a big difference in enforcing the legal right that every resident has to high-quality care.
Are there, I guess, books, are there instructions or sites that one can go to sort of learn more about dealing about the things that we're talking about, whether it's, you know, getting the proper documents, whether it's evaluating what facility to go into, or, you know, different methods of financing? Because people are starting to confront this more and more as we are living longer, thanks to medical technology. I mean, the life expectancy when they put Social Security in place was for a male is around 65. Now you're seeing the average life expectancy for a male into the, you know, mid or late 70s. And for women, it's in the 80s. We're seeing people live well into their 80s and 90s today. So you're more likely to confront these very issues.
Absolutely. And I'll give you three websites that have a lot of information that families can find to be very helpful, and also will point people to other websites as well. And I begin, once again, I'm president of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. We have a website, www.naela.org, www.naela.org. And our website has a section on information that is available to the public on all sorts of matters having to do with elder law and long-term care. Second, the American Association of Retired Persons, now just goes by AARP, has a very good website and lots and lots and lots of information on the website, as well as lots of brochures and booklets that individuals can obtain. So I would recommend getting on the AARP website as well. And then third, a lot of the families with whom I work are dealing with Alzheimer's disease, and the Alzheimer's Association also has a very good website. So if your loved one has Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Association website provides lots of very helpful information that families find very valuable.
Final question. Let's say you are in a situation where you have a loved one that is going to have to go into a long-term care facility. First, you mentioned the ways of financing. You start with savings. If you have some savings, but you don't have long-term care insurance, what are the sources or what avenues can an individual pursue to try to pay for this? Because as you just mentioned in your area, $100,000, I imagine here in California, it's probably a similar cost.
Another real good question. With respect to paying for long-term care, if you have a family member who needs long-term care, even if they have long-term care insurance, but certainly if they don't, you really need to get together with a qualified elder law attorney. And the NALA website allows individuals to enter in a state and get to attorneys in particular cities who can assist with this. And what the attorney can do is to advise the family on all of the different steps that can be taken to accomplish the three objectives that we talked about earlier, which are, number one, making sure that the person who needs care gets quality, quick care and as independent an environment as possible. Secondly, that if there is a spouse, that we financially protect that spouse. And thirdly, that we protect and best utilize life savings to accomplish these goals. But people really can't do that on their own. They really need qualified legal counseling.
Mr. French, if our listeners would like to contact your firm or find out more about the organization NALA, how could they do so, please?
With respect to NALA, the NALA website is www.naela.org. And contact the website would be a good start. With respect to my firm, and I work throughout the state of Ohio, the probably best way to reach me is just for people to send me an email. My email is simple, gfrenchlaw@aol.com. For Gregory French, gfrenchlaw@aol.com.
Well, Mr. French, I want to thank you for joining us here on our Lifetime Income series. This is an issue that, as I mentioned as we began, more and more Americans, either children or well spouses, are facing in their retirement years. I appreciate the information you provided, and thanks for so much information. Come back and talk to us again.
You are very welcome. Thank you for having me on, and NALA and I are happy to be of whatever assistance in the future. I enjoyed it, and your questions were excellent. You made it easy.
Thank you, Mr. French. Well, that concludes our interview with Mr. French, who is a certified elder law attorney. And once again, he mentioned several websites if you'd like to find out more information. One of them, as he talked about, is Medicare itself. And you can go to the Medicare, that's medicare.gov. And you can find out, for example, the ratings of long-term care facilities in your state or city if you're considering such a measure. And then also the NALA website, which is naela.org. If you need, let's say, legal assistance, ARP.org, A-A-R-P. and, of course, the Alzheimer's Association. Because you do need to do a lot of this yourself, because there are a lot of decisions that are going to have to be made. And remember, as we began this interview, we talked about three critical documents. One is the health care power of attorney, a living will, and a financial power of attorney, because you're going to have to deal with several decisions. Number one, what kind of care? Two, the facility, how to select the right facility, and then how to pay for it. So these are big and expensive decisions. You heard him mention in the area of Cincinnati, long-term care can cost as much as $100,000 a year. That's a lot of money. Anyway, on behalf of Kaplan Harris and myself, I'm Jim Poplava. We'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.